Looking forward to talking to this gentleman, NFL Films senior producer Ray Didinger, of course, an accomplished author, football Hall of Fame writer and broadcaster, and he's going to be on to talk football past, present, and future with us. Ray, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the show. This is the show where nothing is off topic, sports and otherwise, but I got to tell you, anybody who can talk all aspects of football, that's a particular weakness of mine, so what a pleasure to have you on the show here tonight.
Well, it's good to be with you as well.
It's great to do this here. Something I'd like to ask you about. Let's start with something that is a soft spot of yours, that being your Philadelphia Eagles here. And I read in one of your past columns here something that sounds similar in some ways to some insights that I had had from the outside looking in. And I just want to know basically how much overlap we have here. You critiqued one of the sore spots, I think, for Eagle fans, which is the run-pass ratio that Andy Reid employs for the team. And it's often very lopsided. Now, I look at this roster, and I tend to be critical in one sense of Andy Reid and defensive of him in another sense. I'm defensive of him for not giving more opportunity to Kurrell Buckhalter because, frankly, I've never seen anything that indicated to me that he really deserved more of an opportunity. To me, he is what he is. But I'm critical of him in the sense of acquisition. I feel as though they have needed for years to get a move the chains running back to supplement Brian Westbrook. Most of the rest of the league is going to a ratio where you have a lead back, but he is platooned, at least in some small way, by a change of pace back. I've seen them for years as needing that type of a back who could keep Brian Westbrook fresher, who could move the chains in bad weather, who could give this offense the missing element that it hasn't had. So what are your thoughts close to where you sit as an Eagles observer?
Well, to some degree, I think, just philosophically, yeah. I think that, over the course of the 10 years when Andy's been the head coach here, I just think that his run-pass ratio, I thought, has always been too heavily tilting towards the pass. I think they have strayed way too far away from the run way too often. I think it's cost them games in the regular season. It's cost them some big games in the postseason. Part of it is just, and part of the problem that has developed is just Andy's general construction of the team. I mean, if you look at it this year, I mean, you point out that they kind of are down to one real productive back, and he's a very productive back, but he's one back, and that's Brian Westbrook. But other than that, I mean, you look around, they don't have a tight end that can block any of them. Your two tackles are both in their mid-30s, and Runyon was basically playing on one leg this year. They lost Sean Andrews early in the year, and they never found a replacement for him. They have a center who's, I think, real limited. So, to me, it was always a bit of a dilemma. I mean, I'm a big proponent of running the ball more. I think they should. But then I look at what they have up front and the things that you need and a fullback. I mean, they went into the season without a fullback. They tried to make a go of it with a converted defensive tackle. So part of the problem, I think, was the general construction of the team. As good as Westbrook has been, and even though he was hurt this year, he wasn't the same player, but as good as Westbrook has been over time, they've never really surrounded him with the elements that make up a good running game. I wish they would run more, but part of it is you look at the team that he takes out of training camp and brings into the season, and you say, you know what, this isn't a team that's really equipped to run the ball all that well. And I think that in their off-season evaluations, I keep thinking that every year when they go to do their off-season evaluation, they're going to step back and say, you know what, we really do need to address this. We really do need to go get a real fullback. We really do need to go get a tight end who can block. We really do need to shore up the A-gap in the offensive line. Do all those things to put ourselves in a position where we can run the football efficiently. And, they never really do.
Well, my thoughts are very similar on that, and I must say, Ray, that it's for that reason, and those thoughts that I had led me astray as far as what to expect, because I dismissed it as just this trendy media meme that the Eagles were the Giants of this year, and the Eagles were going to beat the Giants in that game. And I said going into that game, boy, was I wrong. I said, who the Giants of this year are? The Giants. I totally dismissed the Plexico Burress situation there, and I was way wrong on that because they're not the same team without him. But how surprised were you? I mean, everybody, it seemed to be a trendy thing to pick the Eagles to win that game, and hey, for once, the trendy people had it their way. How surprised were you, or unsurprised as the case may be, that they were able to pull off that win?
Oh, I was surprised. I was surprised. I didn't think they were going to win. I didn't make any friends in Philadelphia that week because I picked the Giants. And, you know, and the prevailing sentiment, you're right, nationally, a tremendous number of national people picked the Eagles. And, of course, in Philadelphia, everybody was picking the Eagles. But I picked the Giants because I just thought, you know, and I recognized that without Burris, they really were a profoundly different team. I mean, there was no doubt about that. But I still felt I had seen the Eagles play so inconsistently over the course of the regular season and so poorly so often. I mean, you can't play any worse than they played in Washington the next to last week in the season. So the thought that they could go into Giant Stadium twice in 5 weeks and beat the defending Super Bowl champions, put together two efforts like that, and beat the Giants twice, I just didn't see it happening. You know, the Giants played really badly the first time the Eagles went up there, and the Eagles really dominated that game. Of course, that was just days after the Burris shooting, and the Giants actually played like they were sort of in shock. But I really thought that getting another chance to play the Eagles in the postseason at home, refocused, embarrassed by what happened before, as the defending champions, you know, I really thought that the Eagles were going to get the Giants' best shot in that game. And they really didn't. I mean, again, the Giants played poorly. I give the Eagles credit. They played well. But I didn't expect that. I thought the Giants would win that game. And when the Eagles won, I was surprised. And then, you know, I thought going to Arizona, I remember writing a column for the Comcast website in Philadelphia where the lead of my story was, don't take the Cardinals lightly. Because everybody in Philadelphia, the same people that were picking the Eagles to win over the Giants, and they were right there, just vaulted right past Arizona, right to Tampa. That after the Eagles beat the Giants, they said, well, my goodness, look at this. What a break we caught. Arizona knocks off Carolina. We beat Arizona by 4 touchdowns on Thanksgiving night. This is like a free ticket to the Super Bowl. And the feeling in the city was one of the NFC Championship game was going to be a walkover. And I didn't feel that way. After having watched what Arizona did against both Atlanta and Carolina, I thought the Cardinals were going to be a challenge. And, boy, did they ever prove to be a challenge.
Well, it certainly was quite a challenge. I have to say, again, I was wrong on the NFC Championship game as well. Didn't think it would be a walkover, but I thought in a narrow game, Philadelphia, I thought, would prevail. And I'm wondering what this says, or doesn't say, as the case may be, about the quote-unquote sanctity of the regular season. Because you talk about Philly, what happened to them in a couple games, and that shameful effort against the pathetic Cincinnati Bengals. But Arizona's got their own sob stories, going up to New England and pretty much rolling over and playing dead. I mean, you have to look at this, and you have to say, you know, these games in November and December that supposedly are sacrosanct and tell us so much about what we're going to see in the playoffs, boy, in the NFC this year, those games didn't tell us anything.
Well, it's kind of typical of the way the league is right now. I mean, it's very even. I mean, things change so much from week to week. It was very hard, really, from week one right through the end of the season to identify who the really good teams were. It was very hard to get much of a fix on it. The Eagles were kind of reflective of that. I mean, they had stretches this year where they played really well. I mean, you look at the two teams that played in the Super Bowl this year, played what I think was the best Super Bowl we've seen, to be honest with you. It was a great game. Both teams played really well. And those are two teams that the Eagles beat soundly during the regular season. I mean, beat the Steelers, beat them up physically, sacked Roethlisberger 8 or 9 times, won a game handily with them in September. And then, as I said, on Thanksgiving night, beat the Cardinals by 4 touchdowns. And those are the two teams that played in the Super Bowl while the Eagles sat home. It was, I guess from an entertainment standpoint and from a fan standpoint, it makes for a great league because, I mean, we have really reached the point of Burt Bell's dream where on any given Sunday anybody can beat anybody. But for guys like us that try and make a living sitting on the side trying to analyze this and make sense of this, it can be really frustrating. I look at the Eagles every week, but I also look around the league, and sometimes I get the feeling that I can't tell which side of the looking glass I'm on.
Oh, I can understand that, because to me, what happened with Arizona, in some ways, it was a bit reminiscent of that run that the Colts went on a couple of years ago, where they had that offense that just couldn't do anything against the run. Now, in their case, they got back Bob Sanders for the playoffs, and we know what a difference maker he can be, and for anybody who didn't know, they found out. I mean, it was not completely inexplicable the way that they tightened up playoffs 2 years ago and went on that run, but this year, I mean, for Arizona, you're left to just kind of scratch your head and say, how could they be this good in the playoffs and be so stinko in the regular season? For everybody that was patting Betsy Pendergast on the head and saying what a great job. I was kind of wondering, where has your defense been all year? This is a defense that's better than the sum of its parts, didn't show it during the season, and evidently the Cardinals must have agreed with that because Mr. Pendergast was left looking for a new job.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, the Cardinals had some performances this year on the defensive side that were, you could only describe them as embarrassing. I mean, the game up the Meadowlands against the Jets, flat out embarrassing. The game against the Eagles on Thanksgiving night, embarrassing. Game at the up in Foxborough against the Patriots, embarrassing. I mean, if you had told me at any point there, if you had told me Thanksgiving night after watching the Eagles dismantle that team at Lincoln Financial Field that the Arizona Cardinals were going to be in the Super Bowl. I mean, I'm not a betting man, but I would have bet anything that was not possible. I mean, a defense that gives up 426 points is going to play for the world championship? I don't think so. But that's what you saw. You know, I mean, schematically, X's and O's wise, yeah, they did some things differently in the postseason, but to a large degree, it was just a matter of some guys who were really talented players just raising the level of their games. I mean, Antonio Smith is a really good player, but didn't show at all times during the regular season, but really played well in the postseason. Dockett played out of this world in the postseason. You know, Carlos Dansby, who's a tremendously talented player, finally played like that in the postseason. You know, Adrian Wilson is a guy that pretty much gives you what he's going to give you week to week. He's just a real good, solid player. And Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie just grew as the season went along as a rookie, and by the postseason was playing with a lot of confidence and playing really well. But you had some other guys on that team that I just thought kind of underachieved in the regular season, and then in the postseason just kicked it up several notches.
Oh, absolutely. And something I want to ask you about here, too, as far as teams go, in looking at the books that you've written here, and of course, these can all be found, I believe, on Amazon.com as well as other places, The Super Bowl, Celebrating a Quarter Century of America's Greatest Game, Plans for Success, Winning Strategies for Business and Life from 10 Top NFL Head Coaches, Eagles Encyclopedia, and the one that really caught my eye, Football America, Celebrating Our National Passion with Don Shula. Because I will tell you, Ray, I'm a born and bred Clevelander lifelong, but in the late 70s, growing up, you know, as a bespeckled youth, I kind of adopted the Dolphins also. I mean, as a scrawny little kid with glasses, Bob Greasy was kind of like a role model, and I kind of adopted that team. Now, I wasn't old enough to appreciate the perfect team, but I've adopted sort of all things Dolphins along with the Browns here. So I might have been the only person in America a year ago when everybody was hollering for the Patriots to wipe the 72 Dolphins off the map. You know, I'm the only guy probably who was happy who said the only thing that could have made it any better is if Don Shula would have bummer rush to the 50-yard line with a bottle of Cristal after the game and celebrated there. I love the 72 Dolphins, Ray, and what I'd like to do is have you, from your perspective of having worked with the coach, tell the people about this team what they don't know but should know. Everybody's got it in their heads that, oh, this is the worst great team of all time, and they were so lucky, and they didn't beat a winning team during a regular season. This team gets no respect. I'd like to have you, from your perch, just say something to let the people know how underappreciated this squad was.
Oh, I think they're a great team. It sort of baffles me that the people now feel like they have to find reasons to knock them or somehow diminish what that team accomplished. I mean, it's the greatest team accomplishment in the history of professional football. I don't know how anyone, you know, I think anybody'd be pretty foolish to try and diminish that and just look at the comparative records and say, well, look who they beat and look at these. Well, no, they did something that, you know, for years and years have been playing. I mean, for generations have been playing professional football in this country, and teams have had hard schedules and teams have had easy schedules. And there have been teams that have come along and we've called dynasties, and there have been teams that have called and said these guys are great and have produced X number of Hall of Famers. But none of them were able to do what the 72 Dolphins did. And for anybody to try and somehow poo-poo that or say, well, it isn't what it appears to be. No, it is exactly what it appears to be. It is the one and only perfect season in the history of the National Football League, and it should be recognized and celebrated as such. I like those guys. I did a working for NFL Films over the last 2 years, we did a series of one-hour specials that aired on the NFL Network. And the series was called America's Game. And they were one-hour shows, each one, on each of the Super Bowl champions. So that we've now done 43 in the series. The one on the Steelers is underway now. And I did three of those shows. I did the Steve Young 49ers, and I also did the Dolphins of 72 and the team that repeated in 73. I did, so I spent a lot of time immersed in those Dolphin teams. And I had always appreciated them. I knew how good they were. I knew some of the guys. But when I really began looking at the film and I really began breaking down the numbers and interviewing those players, you know, I got a greater appreciation for just how good that team was. You know, I mean, in many ways they were I don't know if revolutionary is exactly the right term, but the thing is, I mean, they did some things. Don Shula did some things with that team that were really ahead of their time. I mean, you know, we all see teams now that have these rotating backs and they have situation players. You know, they have, you know, the backs that play in this formation and in this part of the field, and then they have these other backs that play in their so-called red zone. Well, Shula was doing that back in the 70s. I mean, when you look at that team, the mileage you got, I mean, Zonka was the constant. Zonka was on the field at all times and was a true fullback, as we have always defined fullbacks in pro football back in the day, fullbacks that weren't just blockers but were 1,000-yard rushers and averaged 5 yards a carry, if you can imagine that. But at the halfback position, I mean, he beautifully divided the time between Jim Kick, who was a terrific receiver and blocker, and Mercury Morris, who was just an absolutely electrifying outside runner. And when they were running situations in the middle of the field, Mercury was on the field. When they got down in the red zone or it was third down, they would put Kick on the field and throw the ball to him. And it was just a beautifully designed offense with I think the best offensive line I've ever seen in terms of their execution and precision, and one of the most underrated great players in the history of this league, in Paul Warfield, who averaged 20 yards a catch for his career and has the highest ratio of touchdowns per reception of any player that's ever played in this league. And on top of all that, you know, a great defense that allowed virtually no points, a defense that actually pitched a shutout in its first Super Bowl. I mean, the only touchdown the Redskins scored was on Gary Apremian's goof on a special teams play. And on top of all that, they had a perfect season with the backup quarterback. So, you know, for anybody to look at that team and try and somehow diminish or just say, well, they weren't, oh, yeah, well, yeah, they're undefeated, but they weren't that good. I mean, to me, that's just, I don't want to say it's ignorant, but to me, it's just, I think it's just not giving this team what they deserve. They have a very special place in history, and in my mind, they earned it.
Oh, I agree completely. I'll say also, too, it's kind of funny, Paul Warfield, that's a name that kind of twists the knife in this town, because Mike Phipps is pretty much, that's a curse word to this day, that deal that was made. But I tell you what, with the Dolphins, too, of that time, and again, do I have an axe to grind because I love the Dolphins and I hate the Steelers? Absolutely, but I always like to say there's a tremendous what-if there, because the WFL came in and took some key components out of this Dolphins team that you just were talking about a minute ago there, Ray, and it would be a heck of a what-if to look at the mid-70s and late 70s and see if the Dolphins could have stayed toe-to-toe with the Steelers basically on an even footing.
Yeah, you could make that argument. I mean, you really could. I mean, who knows what would have happened to that Dolphin team if Zonka, Kick, and Warfield hadn't gone and signed with the World Football League. I mean, who knows? I mean, the very next year, they won back-to-back and then, you know, lose on that amazing Ken Stabler play in the championship game a year later, which opens the door then for the Steelers to begin making their run. But, that was just... You know, when I looked, I mean, I knew how good they were. I really did. But when I began looking at the film to try and begin putting the film on that team together, and I looked at the footage, and the thing that I kept going back to was just how great that offensive line was. And I don't mean to diminish Zonka, Kick, and I don't mean to diminish Zonka, Kick, and Morris at all. I mean, they're all terrific backs and perfectly suited for their roles. But boy, that offensive line was good. I mean, they were, you know, Monty Clark did a great job coaching that team, and those five guys played with unbelievable precision and consistency. And, you know, Langer's in the Hall of Fame, and Larry Little is in the Hall of Fame, and I think it's a real shame. It's a real shame that Bob Kuchenberg isn't in, because I think he was the equal of the two guys that are in Canton. And I know Cooch has been a finalist for the Hall of Fame now. four or five times now and has never quite gotten over the threshold. But I would like to get the voters in a room and just show them the same films that I watched in putting that film together and just sort of circle number 67 and say, watch this guy. And I think it wouldn't take very long before guys would be ready to put him in Canton.
I agree completely with that. Yeah, I'd like to see that that happen. I think that that would help correct an injustice if that were to happen. Sometimes offensive linemen aren't appreciated in their own time, and I can say that in this city, speaking of Gene Hickerson, who it was a shame that he got put in when it was too late for him to appreciate it. Here's hoping it doesn't happen with Kuchenberg. As both of us have referenced, Ray, of course, your gig as senior producer for NFL Films, I have to say, I mean, that is a name that to football fans, you know, NFL Films is spoken of with reverence, and there's a sense that that's got to be just about the coolest job in the world to have if you love football, because you're there. I think of it as almost like a virtual think tank of football there, you know, from Steve Sable on down. You know, you've got minds there like Ron Jaworski and Greg Cosell and some of the other folks that also are employed by them. Just give a sense to the people of what that's like to work in an atmosphere like that where everybody's just, you know, so into football and appreciative of it and knowledgeable about it.
No, I mean, you pretty well described it, actually. I mean, that's if you love football, if you really love football, the inner workings of it, the strategy of it, you know, the beauty of it, really. I mean, it is a beautiful game when it's played right. Boy, NFL Films is the place to be during the season because, I mean, you just walk down the hallways and you look in every room and somebody's breaking down a film or somebody's cutting a film or somebody's going through a special role of a coach that was wired that particular week. And, you know, you go past the room where they're doing the matchup show where you have Ron Jaworski's in there and Charlie Casserly's in there and Matt Millen is in there and you know, sometimes you have Carson Palmer is in there. Just the other day, Joe Flacco was in there. And all these guys are sitting there and they're looking at tape and they're breaking games down and they're taking notes and they're talking strategy. It's tremendous. It really is. If you really are into the game, and not in a casual way, but a serious way, it's a tremendous place to be. The energy level is unbelievable. Everyone takes tremendous pride in working there because I think we all understand what NFL Films represents. It is the standard of excellence in sports filmmaking, really throughout the world. And you think about what NFL Films has done for professional football in the last 40 years. I mean, this sounds self-serving as a guy that's worked for NFL Films for the last 12 years, but you know, I really think the reason the pro football vaulted past baseball and all the other sports over the last 40 years is because the NFL had NFL Films and nobody else had anything like it. I mean, the NFL Films has allowed people to watch this game in a way they can't watch any other game. And, you know, I think it's contributed mightily to the rise in popularity of this league. And, you know, you can trace all of that back and give all the credit to Steve Sable, who is still the president, and his dad, Ed Sable, who was the founder of this company back in 1962. I mean, it's a great American success story. And a big reason why the NFL is sitting on the throne today is because those guys created the mythology, really, that people associate with pro football in this country.
Oh, it really is. And I'll take it a step further and just kind of opine that I would have a hard time seeing the NFL Network exist were it not for NFL Films. I think that's another thing that could be traced back to it as well. And it strikes me that it's only a matter, I think, and it sounds like you would agree with me, a matter of when and not if the Sables both are joining you in Canton, Ohio.
Boy, I sure hope so. I mean, that's I'm a little disappointed that it hasn't happened already. I mean, when you talk about the people that are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, those that have contributed to building this game and growing this game, it'd be hard to name a whole lot of people that have done more in that regard than Mr. Sable, Big Ed as he's known, and Steve. I mean, they are that important to the story of this league and its growth and popularity. And I've talked to a lot of people about why this hasn't happened. You know, why has this not happened yet? And You know, I think it's going to. I think it's inevitable. At some point, the voters there have to recognize that these guys need to be in there. And I just hope it happens while Mr. Sable's still alive to enjoy it. I mean, he's 94 now, and he's still in good health. He's retired, and he's living in Arizona. But, I mean, I would like to see him have that weekend out there because he has certainly earned it. And, you know, people in this country, the beautiful thing about NFL films and what they do is, you know, it was said once by Steve, and he said, you know, if our idea is if you went to the game and you watch our show, you'll feel like you weren't there. You'll feel like you've seen it in a way you never saw it before. But if you didn't go to the game, but you see our film, you feel like you were there because it took you inside to that degree. And I think that's true. I think the way they portray the game, the way that, you know, with the sound and the wirings of the coaches and players, which we're doing more and more of all the time, you know, you've given people an insight into what it means to play in the NFL, that the fans have an appreciation for this game and what's involved in playing this game more so than they have for any other sport.
Hear, hear. I'm hoping that they make it in, you know, as we've said, when they can still enjoy it, both of them, and it not be a situation like Gene Hickerson in football or Buck O'Neill in baseball. You know, we need to appreciate people when they're still around to hear it, or in the case of Mr. Hickerson, you know, able to fully bask in it as is deserved. But
I agree.
You know, when you look at this, again, I know it's, you mentioned here, and I've seen, you know, on your bio, the work that you've done with the NFL films for the NFL Network as far as America's Game. What are some other things that you'd like to mention that NFL Films has got going on, whether it be with the NFL Network or otherwise, and projects that you're working on presently aside from that?
Well, we're still sort of in the wrap-up mode. We're still putting the past season to bed. We're still got some Super Bowl stuff we're finishing up. But what I'm doing now is I'm working on something that's been pretty successful over the last few years are these history of a team two-disc DVDs, which they started doing a few years ago. And, boy, they've been really successful. And each off-season we do two new teams and do a double-disc DVD, complete history of that franchise. And we've done a number of them over the years. I worked on one with the Eagles a number of years ago. I did one with the Steelers. I worked on one with the Jets. And then this year I'm doing one with the Buffalo Bills. That's what I've sort of begun working on is this Bills history film. And it's really a lot of fun. It's to go back, especially when you're dealing with some of these old AFL teams, to go back, and we don't have a lot of footage of them, but what we have is, I mean, it is kind of funny to see what the AFL was back in its first year or two. I mean, these teams playing in high school stadiums and, you know, before crowds that I don't know what they were announcing, but I know what they were. I mean, there were some of these crowds that I see that, I mean, if it was 5,000 people, they were lucky.
Wow.
To think that that's, you know, to think that that's what the AFL was at the start, and, you know, the guys who, the owners who started that league, how they had to fight to keep that league alive and to make it viable, and finally bring it along to a point where by the end of the decade they actually merged and became part of the NFL. Pretty amazing story, and I have really enjoyed doing this. When I did the Jets one a couple of years ago, I was lucky enough that I was assigned the Namath years. So I had the opportunity to do the years from when Namath was drafted right through, and my goodness, I mean, looking at the footage of Namath before his knee injuries and just what a beautiful player he was. I mean, in terms of his drop away from center and setting up in the pocket and his release, my goodness. I mean, I don't know if there was ever a better pure thrower of the football than Namath was in his young years. I mean, he was magic. And I was a young guy, didn't see that much AFL. I kind of saw little bits here and there, obviously, so Super Bowl III. But to look at that on film and just game after game and just watch it, that was a joy. I mean, working on that film, that was an off season I really enjoyed.
Oh, that sounds like a lot of fun, Ray. And I tell you what, here's a free tip for you. That if you're looking to draw the right straw in the office there when it's time to do best of the NFL DVDs, go for the Browns one, because you only have to look for stuff up to 1964, maybe a footnote on the late 80s. That should be a pretty easy one to do, Ray.
No, I'll bet. Well, actually, we did a Browns one. We did a Browns one, might have been last year.
Okay.
We did a Browns one last year because I had the. This was another one where I got lucky. I got the Jim Brown years.
Ooh.
So we did a Browns. We did a history of the Browns film last year, which is double disc DVD. I'm sure if folks go to Amazon or they go to their local video store, they can find it. And it's a terrific film. Jameel Smith, Todd Schmidt, and myself, three guys worked on it, and I got the Jim Brown years. So that was. That was really a lot of fun. These are really great projects. I mean, one of the great joys of working at films is the ability to do that research. And we obviously have all the film in house. I mean, you just go into the vault and pull it out, and you can just put it up on your viewer, and you can get to see Jim Brown with the football under his arm again. And believe me, it's as impressive today as it was in the 50s and 60s.
That's got to be amazing to be able to do that. But as far as being able to disseminate that to a wider public, which is, you know, at least with the hardcore fans, equally appreciative of this kind of stuff here, I often hear the question just from friends of mine, just as we're kind of thinking aloud here, is there ever a time when NFL films, you've got films of every game going back decades, every NFL game anyways, is there ever a time when some of that might be made available perhaps on demand or disseminated to the public in some kind of wider way for them to be able to take advantage, even if it's just key games here and there? Is there any sense of ever opening the vault even wider, perhaps in an uncut way, to the public?
Well, some of that, you know, there are obviously highlight films that are made of every team every year.
Yes.
So there's a 30-minute highlight of every team season going back to when NFL films originated back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Now those are not, I mean, the older ones are not available to the public right now unless you make what is called a special order. I mean, you can contact NFL films and talk to one of the folks in the purchasing department, and you can order the 1956 Cleveland Browns highlight. You can get it. Now, the thing is, they will have to pull the film off the shelf, and you know, they will have to run you a special copy. So obviously it involves stock, it involves labor, it involves that stuff. So the highlight film will probably cost you, I'm saying, you know, $50-$60.
Mm-hmm.
But they can do that for you. It all exists. But one of the things that they are trying to do is they're trying to do more in the off season to turn around these kinds of games and make them available. Time Warner has been working with NFL Films in the last few years to do more of these history of a franchise DVDs or the greatest games series, doing 1-hour films that are reconstructions of some of the great games in NFL history. Every year we do 3 or 4 of those that are now made available as a 1-hour video. And somebody can, you know, and anybody who's interested can contact NFL Films, and they can send you a catalog of all the stuff that actually is available and orderable. You know, I'm not talking about calling up and having one specially made for you.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there this stuff does exist, and there is a catalog that you can order that will tell you what's available and how much it'll cost and how you can order it. So if anybody's out there and really does want to take us up on that, just contact NFL Films, ask for the catalog, and see what's there. You might be surprised. It's actually a pretty good inventory.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, and I would be surprised if there weren't some listeners and viewers tonight to take you up on that, because, again, it's just such a rich mother load that you guys have got there, and it just, you know, that's something that I would have an interest in myself. To bring this full circle, Ray, I said I wanted to talk past, present, and future with you on the game here. I know that in some of your writings, you've been known to cover NFL draft prospects and looking at the future of the game. I'm just wondering, you know, with the All-Star Games now behind us, with the Combine just in front of us here, at this point, is there anybody who's kind of caught your eye, who is a little bit underrated still in the public eye, who isn't getting a lot of attention yet, but you feel could be a good draft value?
Oh, in this coming draft?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't really started serious preparation for the draft. My impressions are just those of somebody who just watched college football this year and took some notes. I haven't really begun what you would consider real study or preparation.
Mm-hmm.
coming into the draft. But yeah, I mean, I was I mean, there were some players that really that I kind of thought were interesting. I mean, the young running back from Georgia, Knowshon Moreno.
I like him.
I just liked him a lot. I mean, he's, you know, I didn't think they had a particularly great offensive line this year, but yet every time I saw this kid, he was making his own daylight. He's got just amazing instinct and vision. You know, not the biggest guy in the world, but a very explosive first step, great lateral quickness, the ability to find a hole and hit it. You know, I think he's got a chance to be a really good player at the next level. And, you know, for the same reason I thought Matthew Stafford, the quarterback from Georgia, I mean, I don't know that, you know, when Matt Ryan was coming out last year, Ron Jaworski and I were watched a lot of tape on him, and we were both of the opinion that this kid has a chance to be, well, not just has a chance to be, but is going to be a franchise quarterback. We both felt very strongly on that. And I'm a little bit biased because he's from Philly and he went to high school. His high school is literally right out my back door. So I got to see him play at Penn Charter. And I knew what kind of player he was. I wasn't surprised by his success at BC. I really wasn't that surprised by his success in Atlanta. And anybody that thinks it was a fluke and he was a flash in the pan, you're very mistaken. I mean, that's a kid who's going to win a championship before he's done, and maybe sooner rather than later. And I'm not saying Matt Stafford is Matt Ryan, but he has a lot of those qualities. And, you know, I think I would be very surprised if he's not a top three pick in the draft. He's got just a tremendous arm and has that same kind of competitiveness and leadership, that other quality, that other dimension that you see in great quarterbacks. I'm not surprised that he's coming out, and I think, you know, as I said, I would be surprised if he was not one of the top three picks. And if I had number one, I'm not so sure he wouldn't be my number one pick.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and I think he may go in that spot. And I'm very glad you validated me on Knowshon Moreno, because some of my friends who are analysts don't agree with me. But, yeah, I'm very taken with him as well.
And, really?
We have a gentleman here who does a show, and his site is gridironevaluations.com, Ken Becks. And I respect, I mean, he's, as far as folks who I know personally, he's the greatest evaluator of film that I ever deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I respect his opinion greatly, but my gosh, you know, he thinks he's maybe a little bit undersized for the skill set that he has, doesn't see him as being as explosive as I do. It's just it's not that he thinks he's a bad player. It's just that he thinks guys like me are too enamored of him. So I'm very glad, Ray, to hear you validate me on that, because I share your opinion of him. I'm very excited about his pro future.
Me too. I mean, I've heard people compare him to Cadillac Williams, and I see the similarities. But I think this kid, and I think Cadillac's a good player. I mean, when he's healthy, he's a heck of a player. But I think this kid has a little bit more explosiveness and a chance to be even better. If he can stay healthy. The size you worry about a little bit, but listen, to be a running back in the National Football League, I mean, they all take their lumps, and they all have run the risk of getting hurt. I mean, whether you're Brian Westbrook size or whether you're Brandon Jacobs size, I mean, it's the nature of the position. You're going to get dinged. I think you just go with the raw talent of what you see. And to me, it's all about the eyes, the instinct, and the acceleration. You know, the patience to find the hole and the acceleration through it. There are some backs that to me have that to me is one of the things I don't really understand about the combine or the 40-yard dash. I mean, to me, the game isn't about 40-yard dash. It's all about lateral quickness, peripheral vision, acceleration, and courage. I mean, the willingness to see the daylight and hit it. You know, you can't judge that by putting a guy in a pair of shorts and having him run 40 yards in a straight line. I mean, you can only see it by watching a guy compete at a high level and run the ball in the fourth quarter on his 30th carry. That's when you learn if a guy's a player or not. And so sometimes I think teams make a big mistake by investing way too much in what they see at the combines. You know, judge by what you saw the guy do on the football field, because that's what you're drafting. You're drafting a football player. And I think Moreno is that kind of player. I think he's very competitive. I think he's very talented. And, you know, I think your friend there is kind of typical. I've had some discussions with some people who aren't nearly as high on him as I am, and as a result, I think he's probably going to slip to the later portions of the first round, But I think whoever gets him is going to get a real good player.
I think it'll be a steal. And I tell you what you just said about him and the way you described him, reminiscent of one of the most revered players ever to come out of this state, Chris Spielman. They said a lot of the same things about him as far as how he looked on film versus how he would stand up at a combine. And a lot of times, Ray, it's about just being a football player as opposed to the measurables.
Oh, sure. I mean, I can't tell you over the years, and I've been doing this a long time, I mean, just arguments I would have with guys I like, you know, people whose opinion I respect, but just differ. I mean, I remember a scout telling me when we're going back a ways, but when Marcus Allen was coming out of Southern Cal, say, you know, Marcus Allen is never going to be an impact player in the NFL. And I said, you're out of your mind. And he said, no, look at the 40 time. He's not fast enough. He doesn't have the speed to be an impact player in the NFL. I was like, well, how fast does he have to be to score from the 5-yard line? He was the best red zone goal line runner I had ever seen at the college level. And to me, there was no reason why he couldn't be that at the pro level. Plus, he could do everything. I mean, he had been a fullback. He'd been a blocker for Heisman Trophy winners. He could catch. He could run. He was competitive. He was smart. I mean, I don't care what he ran the 40 in. I mean, if you watched him play, you knew this guy was an elite player. And he came into the NFL, and of course, he had a great career, a Hall of Fame career. But that happens all the time, and that to me is what really makes the draft so fascinating. I mean, that's why people are so fixated on it, because everybody has opinions, they all differ, and you know, it's the one weekend a year where we can all be a general manager of our own teams. And the best part is, when it's all said and done, there's no accountability.
Oh, absolutely. That's what makes it so fascinating. And again, for the NFL draft and for many of the things we've talked about tonight, it all comes down to having just eyes for the game, knowing how to watch film, knowing what to look for. And, Ray, of course, that's certainly the case with you. I'd just like to see also here if there's anything else that you'd like to mention or you'd like to plug. I know in terms of multimedia, you've got a lot going on. You mentioned your column for the Comcast site, of course, the show on WIP in Philadelphia, ongoing work with NFL Films. Anything else you'd like to put out there as far as things you're working on that our audience should know about?
No, I just, you mentioned it earlier. I mean, I've got a number of books that I've done. The Eagles Encyclopedia did the year after the Super Bowl, and last year I published my ninth book, which is called One Last Read, which is a collection of my favorite columns from my 27 years in newspapers. And, you know, there's a lot of football in there, obviously, but there's also baseball and hockey and basketball and some of the stuff I did on the Olympics. So that's called One Last Read, and that's available on Amazon, and that's also Temple University Press. And I'm just finishing up my latest book, which is going to be out in the fall, which was really a lot of fun. And it's called The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies. And it's a look at just the history of sports movies, how they began, how they've evolved, and a whole bunch of stuff about the ones we love and the ones that were bad. And it was, of all the things I've written over the years, I don't think I've ever had more fun than I had writing this. This was really a fun book, and it'll be out in the fall. And, I'm hoping that people find it and read it, because I think they'll, if they enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it, they'll have a good time.
Oh, that's great. And I tell you what, Ray, between now and the time when this comes out to press, we'd love to have you back on the show. It was a real pleasure just getting to talk football with you here tonight. And, again, I think our audience got a real feel for everything in your background and everything you've accomplished in the world of football. Very deserved member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Again, we'd love to have you back on with us sometime, Ray.
Hey, anytime. Just give me a call.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ray. It was a real treat.
Same here. Take care now.
Oh,
bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Ray Dittinger, everybody, senior producer at NFL Films, and, again, accomplished Philadelphia sports writer, author, broadcaster, et cetera, et cetera. Just a lot of fun to talk to this gentleman. I was looking forward to it.